Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now you can feel like you're in the audience at the Ed Sullivan Theater with official Late Show with Stephen Colbert merchandise at ParamountShop.com. Shop t-shirts, mugs, accessories, and more. And Late Show Pod Show listeners can take 20% off with code TLS20. That's 20% off at checkout on all Late Show products with code TLS20 at ParamountShop.com. It's The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. My guest tonight is a husband, father, military veteran, and activist. He has 3 dogs, 2 kids, and lives in Southern California. He is also the Duke of Sussex. Please welcome to The Late Show, Prince Harry. There you go.
All right. Just the spare?
That's the spare.
That's the spare.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Thank you for bringing in the crowd. You know?
There you go. Thank you so much for being here. And you're absolutely right. You might have missed it, but Harry said, "Is this the chair and the spare over there?" Well done. Well played. Well played, sir. Now, it's lovely to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on to talk about your new book. What should I call you?
You call me whatever you want at this point.
Is it Harry?
I'm stuck here until we stop talking. So.
Well, in the book, I find you've got a lot of different names. Your birth name is Henry. Your father and your brother often call you Harold. Some people call you H. Dear friends called you Haz. What is Haz? Is that short for hazardous?
It's not. My wife calls me Haz, so you can't call me Haz.
Okay. Harry, is Harry okay?
Yeah, Harry, Haz, Baz, Bazza, Spike, Bazzaroony. It's all there.
Bazzaroony. Prince Bazzaroony.
No, the prince doesn't come before that.
Oh, okay. No. It's its own title in
it's
and of
its
itself.
Own thing. It's like a code word.
Well, you've written this very intimate memoir, which I've read, and it's fascinating. It's a very good read by itself. It's available today. A lot of sensational leaks in the days coming up to this. I know that you yourself are a very private person for being a public figure. You're revealing a lot of things in here. It must be on a certain level kind of nerve-wracking to be out there to publicly and physically represent the book. Mm-hmm. Would you like a cocktail before we begin?
Yes, please.
I hear you like tequila.
Does he ever make you guys a drink or not?
There you go. No, it is. Sure, I'm not sure.
Everyone wants a drink. Everybody wants a drink. Okay.
Exactly. They're already on your side, man. You don't have to get them drunk. All right. Are you glad now to be out here so people can see this book after all these leaks, so they can see the context of these remarks?
Yes, context is everything, as we know. Look, writing this book has been a cathartic experience for me. Hard times and happy times, bringing up old memories that I didn't think I had. But yes, context is everything, and unfortunately, due to those leaks, the British press, which are central to so much of my story, my 38 years up until this point, and after spending 2 years focused on context, what I'm going to share, how I'm going to share it, and being able to piece it all together, they intentionally chose to strip away all the context and take out individual segments of my life, my story, and every experience that I've had and turn it into a salacious headline.
Well, there are problems...
Which is somewhat typical.
Right, especially if you read this book, you find out how typical that is.
Yes.
Now, there's a lot of faults in the American press, and people from all different stripes can see that in the American press. But the British press is almost odd to me. It's sort of bizarre how vicious they can be. You detail a lifetime of dishonorable behavior like the kind you're describing, and not only from the press, but from palace sources, in palace insiders, who would not only not defend you, but also plant stories that were derogatory toward you and placed you and your loved ones under attack. And judging the last few days, that hasn't changed.
Nothing's changed.
Okay. Do you think that right now there is an active campaign by the rest of your family, by the royal house, as it were, to undermine this book and you as you support it?
Of course, and mainly by the British press, because they
are... But aided and abetted by the palace.
Again, of course, but this is the other side of the story, right? After 38 years. They've told their side of the story, this is the other side of the story, and... There's a lot in here that, you know, perhaps makes people feel uncomfortable and scared. I would say that I think there's some veterans in the house tonight. I think one of the most... look, I'm not going to lie, the last few days have been hurtful and challenging, not being able to do anything about those leaks that you referred to. But perhaps without doubt, the most dangerous lie that they have told is that I somehow boasted about the number of people that I killed in Afghanistan.
I've read that section of the book, and I'm, without reading the entire thing right here, it's a very thoughtful description of what that knowledge is like to have and what the experience is to know that you have done this in order to protect what you believe is good in the world from those who would wish to destroy it. There's nothing boastful about it.
Also, I would say that if I heard anyone boasting about that kind of thing, I would be angry. But it's a lie. And hopefully, now that the book is out, people will be able to see the context. And it is. It's really troubling and very disturbing that they can get away with it.
And also
because they had the context. It wasn't like here's just one line. They had the whole section. They ripped it away and just said, here it is. He's boasting on this. When, as you say, that you've read it, and everybody else will hopefully be able to have a chance to read it. And that's dangerous. And my words are not dangerous, but the spin of my words are very dangerous.
Dangerous because it makes you a increased target, those around you that you love.
And that is a choice they've made.
Another odd thing about it is that this is nothing new. Here's an article from, I believe this is from Reuters, from 10 years ago, describing that you had killed Afghan insurgents, the Taliban, in sorties. So this isn't new information. This has been known for a long time.
Almost 10 years to the day. My face was splattered all over the front pages because someone asked me a question while I was still in Afghanistan if I had killed anybody from an attack helicopter. And I said yes. And I think the most important thing here is not only the context, but the reason as to why I decided to share this in my book. Because, again, to the vets here and to the civilians here, which may feel as though this is slightly a weird conversation to have, especially on this show of all shows, but I made a choice to share it because having spent nearly two decades working with veterans all around the world, I think the most important thing is to be honest and be able to give space to others to be able to share their experiences without any shame. And my whole goal and my attempt with sharing that detail is to reduce the number of suicides.
You talk. You talk in the book. Here we go. There you go. You talk in the book about those years in the military as having saved you. Mm-hmm. And as you said, you still continue to work with veterans, wounded veterans, the Invictus Games. And do you think the UK press is using this specifically to hurt you in an area that is most meaningful to you?
Without question. It's not just an area that they know is the most meaningful, but it is what has defined my life. I spent 10 years in the army. I only joined originally for three. but I couldn't resist staying. And they kept dangling the carrot of different jobs for me for many years. Mm-hmm. But I found a refuge there. And as I talk about in the book, I found my purpose, a purpose greater than myself, and to be amongst comrades wearing the same uniform, being treated, no longer being treated differently for the first time in my life, and being able to hide away from the media focus. For me, that was an amazing place to be, an amazing community, and I still am part of that community. So they will do everything they can to try and disrupt that.
As much as you point out the mendacity and the corruption of the British press, how do you feel about the audience who wants those photos, who wants those stories? I mean, I'm struck by the people who are along the streets, crying as your mother's carriage goes by, as the caisson holding her coffin as you're a boy, and them crying, calling out, and offering their sympathy. Well, there wouldn't be those photos if the public didn't go buy those magazines. Do you have a conflicted feeling about how the audience for that kind of salacious work that gets sold aid and abets it?
Yeah. I think so many of us feed into it. A lot of us feed into it without realizing it. We click on photographs without really considering how that photograph was taken and the story behind that photograph, especially with someone's kids. The way that I look at it now, and again, I talk about it in the book, I was obsessed. I was specifically looking for stories about my wife so that I could educate myself on the opinions that were happening and things that were being said so that I could try to fix it, right? But I think, you know, now for me, I've weaned myself off that because I was slightly addicted to it. Mm-hmm. And now I have a digital diet. And as much as I worry about what I put in my mouth, I worry about what I put through my eyes as well. And my life is so much better for it.
I'm curious. Why do you think, and I know this might seem a simple question or there might be a simple answer here, why do you think the world is so fascinated with your family and at this moment in you? Not, aside from this book, because there was already a press fascination, a public fascination, even when you and your wife were being private, all during COVID out in California. Why do people have an appetite?
Well, first of all, are you talking about my family? Or
your family.
My family, okay.
Well, how about your family and your greater family?
Well, the greater family, I don't know. I mean, I grew up within it. I think there's always been a fascination. I think my mum took it to a new level. You know, Diana's boys, let's see how this turns out. And I think there was a real sense of, in some parts, ownership, some parts, parenthood by the British public, feeling as though they had to parent myself and my brother through our teenage years. Mm-hmm. And then he got married. And it was like, great, there's one. Well, what's going to happen with the other one? I wonder. And then I'm falling out of clubs. I'm taking drugs. I'm drinking heavily. All of that. Again, it's all there. And that was a part... slow drink. but with regard to my family, you hit on a really important point, which is we were forced to leave. We left in 2020. We moved... we fled my home country. We moved to California. And for 12 months during lockdown, where we said literally nothing, it was relentless. And that was a real eye-opener for me. I never thought that we'd be away from it completely, but I did think that we would get some form of peace. But that's when I realized that actually our mere existence outside of that institutional control was more of a threat. And, you know, this is a similar thing that happened to my mum as well. And, look... they always knew that my wife was going to leave because of the way that they were abusing her. But I think the most embarrassing thing is that I just decided to leave with her.
Do they think the intent was to make her to leave or to break her spirit so she would be easier to control? Because either one would
feels
do,
like
right?
A little bit like group therapy. You didn't know, did you? You were saying, I got a dinner reservation. What is this?
Exactly. Well, Harry, let's follow
both,
that feeling.
Both. I think both. I've never seen the level of abuse and harassment that I witnessed over my wife. Other members of the family, they've experienced different forms of that. But to see it happen the way that it happened, I was naive going into it. I didn't realise that the British press would be so bigoted. And even if I had, I wouldn't have accepted or understood that they could get away with it. Mm-hmm. But here we are, and I've now created, or we have created, a fantastic life here in California, which is, by the way, is beautiful, and America is a great place to live.
More with Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex, after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Late Show Pod Show listeners can get 20% off on all Late Show with Stephen Colbert merchandise on ParamountShop.com. That's 20% off at checkout on all Late Show shirts, mugs, accessories, and more with code TLS20 at ParamountShop.com.
The title Spare. How old were you when that name or that description made sense to you in terms of the hierarchy of the family?
When did it make sense? I think
when did you realize that Spare meant like you're, you know, even comedically perceived as like, well, he's a safety cushion.
Yeah. I heard someone go, oh.
You should read the book.
Whoever that was, thank you. I'll give you a hug later. Stop doing it. But yeah, I think, I don't know whether, for a purely American audience, I assume, the air spare is probably something very new, but it is, yeah, it is literally that. You have the air, and then you have the spare. You have the distraction. And if you're not careful, you can really play into that, like some members of my family have, and I fell for that trap when I was, you know, my teenage years, looking for my purpose and trying to work out what was going on.
Your family motto, you say in here, is never complain, never explain.
Yeah.
Okay. But there's also another family motto, which is Dieu et mon droit, you know, God and my right. Mm-hmm. And those are two different things. Mm-hmm. One is to say, like, oh, don't care, don't explain. But the other is very forceful and say, almost like, pardon my expression, damn it, you cannot come for me because I have the right to this position and the right to my actions. Do you see those two in conflict? Does your family really not explain and not complain?
No, it literally is that. It's a motto. That's all it is. For well over a decade, probably two decades, the motto itself is a shield to be able to feed narratives, trading of information, personal information on family members to take one down to build one up. And through unnamed sources, where there are no fingerprints left behind. So, again, one of the reasons why I wrote this book is every word in that book is mine. And I realise that especially...
What do you mean by that?
Because the amount of unnamed sources that have fed information to the British tabloids about me and my wife and my family...
You have a source,
true
and it's you.
...and not true, I am the source of that book. And the difference is that instead of hiding behind, you know... unnamed sources. This here are my these are my words from my lips, from my mouth. And I understand, especially for British people, that it can be incredibly jarring to have my name to a lot of these stories. It is also quite bizarre because a lot of these stories in this book have actually been told already.
The thing that seems redolent when you read the book and you hear your interviews, I get the sense that you're being honest when you speak. And being factually honest, as you say, these are all, you're standing behind all of these stories, but also emotionally honest. And one of the things that was sort of emotionally very affecting to me, even as someone who, again, who doesn't follow the royal family that much, I always assumed after the death of your mother, the two of you, you and your brother, were lockstep. Yeah. You were these solaces for each other who went through this experience together and went through the rest of your lives shoulder to shoulder as the only two who could possibly understand what you'd gone through. But that is not the case.
No, that's not
here. Are you surprised that people are surprised? Because people are surprised.
Are you surprised?
Yes.
Because that has been the narrative. I mean, look, there's two parts to this. One is, I think anyone who suffers from trauma, shock, grief, loss, which we all have and all will, that you have got to put on a brave face. And I think to a large extent, you know, me out there smiling, my brother out there smiling, mm-hmm. us doing working engagements together, it looks a certain way, mm-hmm. especially then when you have the British press, the Royal Rota, of which all of the royal family's information goes through that filter before it then goes global.
That's like the press pool?
Yeah, press pool, yeah. It's exclusive access.
Do you have to say it that way? Legally, is it? Do you have to say it that way?
Yeah. I signed a disclaimer before.
Exactly.
So I can understand why people would think that. But I guess more recently, especially in the last 6 years, it is all the fracture of the relationship between me and my brother has very much been pinned on my wife, funnily enough.
There's a lot of talk about the physical fight that the two of you had, where he pushed you down in the kitchen and broke the dog bowl when you fell on it. It says it broke your necklace. Mm-hmm. What necklace was this that he broke?
This one, which is now fixed and now it's got...
And what's on there?
What do you got there? We got my kid's heartbeats, which my wife gave me.
Oh, like the cardiogram engraved there. Yeah. And what's the central
thing? And then a friend of mine in Botswana made this for me, which has got tiger's eye in the middle.
If your mother were still alive, do you ever think about how she might handle this moment?
We wouldn't have got to this moment.
Talk to me about that.
Well, we wouldn't have done. I don't know where, I don't know what...
There was already crisis in your family. There was already divisions. She was already being hounded. Mm-hmm. So,
it's impossible to say where we would be now, where those relationships would be now, but there is no way that the distance between my brother and I would be the same.
Do you think of how, like, do you sort of mentally or spiritually ask for help as to, like, what can I do to fix this? Any advice she might give you in this moment?
I've said quite a lot recently in these in different interviews that I've been doing that I've really felt the presence of my mum, especially in the last couple of years. And I detail in the book my brother and I talking at her grave and how he felt as though she had been with him for a long period of time and helped set him up with life, mm-hmm. and that he felt she was now moving over to me. And I have felt her more in the last 2 years than I have in the last 30.
The last 2 years is very interesting because you're 38 and she was 36 when she died. Mm-hmm. What was that? What is a moment like when someone at a young age loses a parent? For many people, it's a significant moment when you become older than that parent who's loomed so large in your mind. When you're older than they are, when you've seen more of life than they have, such as it is, what was that moment like for you? Or was it significant at all?
Well, she died at 36, and I was 36 when this all kicked off. as in January of 2020 was when my wife and I basically said, enough, we can't cope, we can't deal with this, we need to carve out something different. So that was an interesting overlap of time.
You talk about her death, or that moment in your life, as being a wall.
Yep.
Over which you couldn't see. Mm-hmm. Was that, how do you see that wall now that you've been through self-reflection, some therapy about that? Have you been able to see over it?
I have. I've definitely been able to see over it. I would say that I haven't necessarily kicked it down, but I've managed to reach to the top and start removing bricks as opposed to poking one through and having a look and poking another one through. The wall has reduced in size. That is partly through writing a book, partly through therapy and having her scent, her perfume, and spraying it and being able to unlock memories that I never thought I had. But there are memories pre-12-year-old Harry that I will never be able to access. And that sucks. That's really sad. But again, I imagine it is so relatable for so many people because as far as I'm concerned, with all the work that I've done on myself, but also the stories that I've heard from so many people, not just veterans, that I'm convinced that 99.9% of people on planet Earth are walking around with some form of unresolved grief, trauma, or loss. And with that comes these filters, of which acts as a fog. And every opportunity we have to be able to clean the windscreen, take the filters away, and actually see life as it is and be able to live a truly authentic life, That, to me, has been the freedom that I've been looking, that I didn't even know that I was looking for most of my life.
You say, like, 99% of people have some trauma. To be alive is to suffer in some way. And so often in this book, you say, I wanted to hug this person, usually a member of your family. I wanted to hug this person. I wanted this person to hug me. And it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. I don't think ever within your family the way that you're hoping that it will. Why, if all of us suffer, and I assume that your family is no different than ours as human beings, why don't y'all hug each other? Why can't you just hug each other? Surely they want to be hugged as well on a certain level.
Yeah, there's a lot of people around who... By the way, I'm a big hugger now. But I did, you know, I was also the kind of individual who, whenever asked when I was younger, how are you feeling? Are you happy? Are you sad? I'm fine. Fine was the easy get out.
Fine. That's what you would say.
Fine was the response that you could guarantee that there wasn't going to be a follow-up question.
Right, also because as a child of trauma, you don't really want to dip into it.
You don't want to dip into it. And I certainly wasn't conscious of the reasons as to why I didn't want to dip into it. All I knew was that there was a defense mechanism.
And no one was helping you do that dipping into it.
No, God, no. I mean, this was back in 1997, right? Therapy wasn't really a conversation that was had. Not within my family and not really within British culture at all. I don't know how you guys were doing in 1997, but it wasn't really a regular thing. But, you know, in one of today's newspapers, apparently I'm trapped in the cult of psychotherapy.
How is it in the cult? Is it nice?
It's warm, it's cozy.
Good. Now, yeah, there you go. So, I want to ask you a couple more other questions, if you don't mind, about... And this is... You engage in something that... I think we discussed this briefly, that I lost several members of my family when I was a little bit younger than you, and I engage in a lot of magical thinking about where they were, and perhaps they weren't dead. And you talk about this all through this book, and it's one of the things that was so resonant to me, mm-hmm. was the belief that, no, my mother is alive. She's out there someplace, yep. and someday she will show up. That's a recurring theme throughout this. What did you have an image of your mind of where she was and what she was doing all this time? For those years,
For many years, I had dreams. I was convinced that she was still alive. I mean, I was, you know, 12 years old. And
did you see her in the world? Did you think you saw her places?
Only a handful of times. Mm-hmm. But I had to believe that she was still alive. I could not face the reality that she was gone.
Where did you imagine she was?
Hiding. Taking a break, plotting, planning, and then coming to get me and William to get us out of there. Because it was unbearable for her.
Hiding, and I think the whole in some world ways, saw that. I mean, hiding, I'm not going to accuse you and Megan of hiding, but removing yourself from the situation, this fantasy that you had of what your mother did, is what you did. You removed yourself from the toxic situation.
Yeah. And I'm glad, by the way, I'm glad that it... not before trying to make it work.
Yes.
Believe me, we tried and we're still trying. But I'm glad that that resonated for you because, as we know through, you know, our own mental health journey, there's power in sharing, right? Because then you realize you're not alone and you realize you weren't crazy thinking that. So I really
hope... is how that person is still alive. If you share your memories of that person, how you feel that person, that is how that person really... That is not magical thinking. That person becomes alive.
No, true, but there's also that grief that so many of us... Look, within society at large, we are not exactly encouraged to grieve. And I think that's a real problem.
It seems a weakness.
It's seen as weakness. But I, through this book, have been the most vulnerable I have ever been in my life. And I've never felt stronger.
What do you... You talk about the love of community in here, not in so many words, but certainly the community of your friends in what's the Club H? Is that what it is?
Club H, yeah.
Club H, below one of the estates, in the army, and you had to leave.
This was the cellar of my dad's house.
Yes.
Just so we're all clear.
Yeah, Club H. Exactly.
You're all invited.
But then you had to leave the most intimate community, which is your family. Sorry? That must have been hard to leave, if you, for someone who wants community so much, to leave the most intimate community, which is your family.
Yes, and one of the hardest bits, which I realized pretty quickly, was the moment that I started doing therapy, it's like we started speaking a different language.
You and your family, that you had a different emotional vocabulary than they were sharing.
It just became very, very different. Yeah, they couldn't understand me, and I was doing my best to try and encourage them to healing. And everyone has their own journey, and I fully respect that. But within that institution, there is a mindset, and there's a lot of people that are hired and brought in that ultimately manage that mindset, and I think it's really, really damaging and dangerous. So, you know, a large reason of why I've written a book is because I want this to stop with me. It makes no sense for me to be able to expose and uncover all of this practice, this toxic relationship between the palace and the press, if I know that someone else in my family is going to be the next target. Because if it's not Meghan and I, it's going to be someone else.
When you were still in the family, were you aware of specific instances when this was happening with the complicity of the palace?
Yeah, it got to the point where every unnamed source, palace insider, senior palace source, everybody was quoted. And then at the bottom, it would say, the palace declined to comment. It's like, right, but the whole article is them commenting. And even today, they're doing the same thing. So I don't know what to say at this point, apart from you keep telling on yourselves.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm asking is that, you know, you were inside the system, therefore you know how the system works.
Yes, which is also terrifying for those people. You
write a lot about your brother. You write about him with love. Mm-hmm. You call him Willie. But there is a different Willie that also gave you some pain and trouble. You got frostbite.
Frostnip
on a delicate part of your anatomy. And you write about this in the book, when you went to the North
now
Pole.
Now they're interested.
Okay. Can you explain how it is that the Royal Standard got frostnip? Walk us through it. Take all the time in the world.
Can I have a drink?
Sure. There you go. Yes.
How long have you been waiting to ask that question?
Since I read the book yesterday.
We've taken quite a leap from grief and trauma to my todger.
Todger, that's a very gentle word.
Is it gentle?
Todger. Sounds like a nice nickname. You know my friends. Here's Willie. Here's Todger. Here's John Thomas.
Well, hang on a sec. Yeah.
But in care for a game of tallywhacker? So how did the...
My Todger make it
how
in?
How did your Todger... I know how it made it into the book. You typed it. But how did it get frost-nipped? Why did you not take care of the royal jewels?
It's really hard to have this conversation because there's no one in this audience that has probably read the book yet, apart from you and me.
So we talk
about context, right?
The context of this is that you're going to the North Pole.
Thank you.
Okay, and things got very cold. At what point did you realize there was a crisis at the South Pole?
Once I got home.
Really?
Yeah.
All the way home?
Yeah.
It took it that long to thaw
out? No, because look, okay. The problem was, first of all, it didn't turn into an icicle, right?
Didn't snap off like a graham cracker.
No, exactly. You can't say. Okay. It wasn't like that.
Never?
Yeah. Well.
Okay, so it seems okay.
It's fine now, thank you. So the context was that these amazing veterans were doing a walk to the North Pole.
Yes.
They had all the training, I had none, and I turned up thinking, how bad can this be?
It's only
the North Pole, it's only minus 35 degrees, I've got the salopettes, I've got the jacket, I've got the warm stuff, I've got all the things that I need. But what I didn't have was what I had when I actually went to the South Pole, which was a cushion. Which, if you... Which is a good...
No one in my life when I was a child could ever explain to me that someday the Duke of Sussex was going to say the words cushion to me. And it would all make sense. This is absolutely surreal.
Well, look, First of all, it's great that it makes sense.
Yes.
Because otherwise I'd move myself into this chair.
Yes. So is it what are we talking about
well,
here?
Well, there was a lovely lady from Helly Hansen who actually...
Is this the beginning of a limerick?
A lovely lady who made a cushion for me, having been told by the guide from the North Pole,
yeah,
he's doing this again.
Yes.
He's going to need some extra protection because the pants that I was wearing, you guys wear pants, underwear.
Trousers.
Underwear.
Oh, pants or underwear, well, yeah, right,
so,
okay, yeah.
Well, yeah. So that's all I had. So my man piece, my Johnson, my Wilson, my Todger, my Willie.
Yes.
All the things and any other words.
Exactly.
If you need to know any other words, I think the Austin yes. Powers yes. sequences are very good.
Yes, the Tower of London.
Exactly. That's new.
Big Ben. mm-hmm. Yes.
The piece was against one layer of clothing or two very thin layers of clothing.
And the cold
to the minus 35. And when you're walking, you're hot and you're yeah. trying not to sweat because the sweat freezes.
Yeah.
And once it's numb, you don't know the pain. It's just
right.
Numb.
So when do you find out? Like, when does it occur to you that something not
weeks,
not as all
weeks
right?
After, weeks after I got back.
Weeks after? And yeah. Why weeks? I don't understand. I mean, do you not take inventory on a regular basis? I'll get to that later. Next week. Next no, week.
No,
you
no,
are a busy man.
Nothing visible.
Oh, really?
Nothing obvious.
Okay.
It was a slow, deteriorating situation.
That's the part we're editing out of this interview.
Very,
boy, right there. All right.
Very
unlike
similar
what?
To this experience.
Unlike, yes. Unlike what? Unlike what?
That's right. You carry on. You were doing great. You were doing great.
No, you're doing great. How's your penis? Doing great? Fantastic. A little antifreeze. A little
There's
antifreeze.
Some people here who are horrified.
Most of them are amused.
Okay. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands.
Now, this is a difficult transition.
You're wearing masks, so I can't really tell whether you're laughing or not.
I want to show this lovely photo right here. There's so much in this book that is actually very heartwarming. The human connection that you have with your family and the times when they've been there to support you. Here's a beautiful photo of yourself and Queen Elizabeth II. And the world mourned her passing last September. You didn't just lose your sovereign, you lose your grandmother. And there are many really lovely interactions between you and your grandmother. What will you remember most about her?
Her sharp wit.
Her sharp wit?
Yeah, her sense of humor, her ability to respond to anybody with a completely straight face, but totally joking.
Wow, just the ultimate British dry wit.
Yeah, but she was incredibly humorous. But as I say in the book, I am now and I was then genuinely happy for her because she finished life. She had an amazing life, she had an amazing career, and she was buried with her husband. And bearing in mind the suffering, global suffering that everybody's experienced over the last 3 years, there was less suffering for both of my grandparents. I'm really, really grateful for that.
Here's another lovely family photo. Your daughter Lilibet, your son Archie, and of course your wife Megan, your daughter Lilibet is named in her honor. Having children helps us remember those that we've lost. Do you see your mother or your grandparents in any of your children?
Definitely my mum. The ginger gene is a strong one.
Look at that. Both of them are redheaded.
The Spencer gene is very, very strong. I actually really genuinely thought at the beginning of my relationship that should this go the distance and then we have kids, that there's no way the ginger gene will stand up to my wife's genes, but I was wrong.
What do you guys do at home? Like, what's fun? Do you guys binge?
Binge.
You guys binge shows?
Binge?
Yeah, binge TV shows?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You watch The Crown, right? You've got to have watched some of The Crown, right?
People love it. Yes, I have actually watched The Crown.
Oh, yeah. Well, the recent stuff or the older stuff?
The older stuff and the more recent stuff.
Yeah. Do you fact check it while you watch it?
Yes, I do, actually. which, by the way, Another reason why it's so important that history has it right.
Well, Harry, thank you so much for being here. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for sharing this. Spare is available today. It's Prince Harry, everybody. Thank you for listening to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert. Just one more thing. If you want to see more of me, come to The Late Show YouTube channel for more clips and exclusives.
Calling all benders and non-benders alike. Jump into the epic world of Avatar with your favorite podcast, Avatar Braving the Elements. Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Each week we'll recap and discuss a new episode.
So come join us and our amazing guests, from creators to cast to superfans, to chat about all things Avatarverse.
It's Fire Nation time. Book of Fire. Let's go. Listen to Avatar Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
Rise and shine, football fans. Start your day the right way with Morning Footy, a podcast that covers every aspect of the global game, headlines, match previews, analysis, interviews, culture, fashion, and plenty of banter. Join as we track the thrills and spills of Europe's biggest title races, the business end of the Champions League season, a summer packed with international competitions, MLS, NWSL, and much more. Subscribe to Morning Footy.